from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, musician Terrell Stafford on how he went from being a classical trumpeter to a computer programmer to a jazz guy. Plus, a young poet whose career took off with her unusually titled first book, Eleanor, Eleanor, Not Your Real Name. But first, as you might have heard, a well-known NPR show is about to end. Day to Day airs for the last time tomorrow morning. It's a popular show, so why has it been cancelled? Joining me from their studio at NPR West are Day to Day's hosts, Madeline Brand and Alex Cohen. Madeline, Alex, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Madeline, since a lot of people seem to enjoy listening to Day to Day, why is it being cancelled?
That's a question I'm not entirely sure I know the answer to. We have more listeners now than ever before, at least the network does. The short answer is that although public radio does have many, many more listeners now than it did just a few years ago, we just don't have the revenue that we used to have, and that's for a variety of reasons. And chief among them is that we relied on a lot of financing from industries that have taken huge hits, financial services and the automobile industry. And so it has trickled down to the cancellation of this show.
Alex, you've contributed to Day to Day for quite some time, but it seems to me that you only actually joined the show as a full-time staffer about a year or so ago. Is that right?
Yes, it's been a long and interesting journey. I've contributed for the show from the beginning, off and on from here and there, and I came back here to Culver City. It's actually a little over 2 years ago now, but my official full-time permanent stamp of approval came a little over a year ago.
So you spent all that time climbing the greasy pole only to have the pole yanked away.
Yeah, you know, that part of it is really sad, but I will say this because we are trying to stay as positive as we can here in our final days. I have the best job in radio, and I really have had for some time. I've, you know, been able to go out and report, and just when I've just been feeling crazy out there in the world of reporting and think, I just want to go sit in the studio for a little while and do some of that, then I get to do that, and then I get to go out and report. I mean, I think we both have been really, really lucky. We're here in California doing radio, reporting and hosting, talking about whatever we want to in the world with a little bit more of an edge maybe than you might hear on some other NPR shows. I think it's a dream job. I'm sad to see it go, but I'm lucky I had the chance, however short it might have been.
Madeline, when NPR opened its studios in the Los Angeles area, NPR West, a couple of shows came out of there, Day to Day and News and Notes, both of which are being canceled. Does that mean that NPR has lost interest in the West Coast?
Well, I guess you could interpret it that way because that is the majority of what goes on in this building. However, the people who make the decisions in Washington rightly point out that the show that has the largest audience, their flagship show, Morning Edition, is hosted from here, co-hosted from here with Renee Montaigne. So they say, no, they are not giving up on the West and that they plan to have a full and plus there are a lot of reporters here, too. Mandalit Del Barco, Carrie Kahn, Karen Grigsby Bates, Mike Schuster is based out here. So there are a lot of reporters here and also reporters in other parts of the West. So they say no, they're not giving up on the West, and they're just going to integrate it more in the other programs that they're not canceling.
I'm talking with Madeline Brand and Alex Cohen, the co-hosts of the NPR show Day to Day, which ends tomorrow morning. Alex, oftentimes when people are about to get laid off, you can kind of sense what's coming. Was that the case at Day to Day, or was it a surprise when you were all told that the show was being canceled?
Well, you know, I think we all knew that this was a very difficult and increasingly difficult economic climate. And I think we all knew that NPR was going to have to make some difficult decisions somewhere down the road. And there is that philosophy of last in, first out. So, you know, I don't think it was something that was completely outside of the realm of any of our imaginations. But I think still, I mean, I think we'll all remember the day was December 10th of last year when we found out. And I think all of us were really quite shocked and saddened.
Yeah, I mean, I think that everyone was sort of reading the tea leaves that, oh, the economy is not doing so well. Look around and look at all these newspapers having a lot of trouble. And, you know, we kept hearing, look, things aren't as great. We had to cut back on travel. In fact, for an entire year, I don't think I traveled. And so there were those kinds of things. But I don't think we thought that the shows, until the very, very last minute, I had no idea that the shows would be canceled, because I didn't realize that NPR was in such dire financial shape. And frankly, I don't think NPR realized it until the fall, because of, you know, the bottom of the financial market just fell out after Lehman Brothers collapsed. So, you know, I think everything happened so quickly, not only at NPR, but in the world, that everybody was taken by surprise.
The first host of Day Today was Alex Chadwick, and he left the show, I guess, just a few months before the show was canceled. Was there any connection? Silence.
No.
Okay. Just wondering.
No. He had not at all. He had planned to leave.
Okay.
And he had taken on a new role as a national desk correspondent. I mean,
right.
That was all part of a bigger plan that was afoot.
Okay.
Right. So no. He had always planned to give it 5 years and then move on and let the show enter a new phase.
Because it's a pretty, I mean, what listeners may not know, we come out of California at 9 o'clock in the morning, which is a reasonable hour. But in order to do that, we're here often well before 6 o'clock in the morning. And it's a pretty intense job, and it's a grueling schedule. Alex Chadwick did it for years and for a long time by himself. And that's a pretty huge feat to have done for as long as he did.
No doubt. Well, we've got a couple of clips of your respective work from Day to Day, and they're quite contrasting pieces. So let's start with Alex, this piece that there was one of a few that you had suggested that we perhaps listen to. And this was when you were talking with Sylvester Monroe, senior editor of Ebony magazine, about the use of the N-word. And we're going to listen to an extended clip from that. But first of all, can you just briefly remind us why you were talking about this on Day to Day?
Sure. This came up about 2 years ago. There's a lot of controversy over some comments that Don Imus had made. And it was something that everybody, I mean, NPR and other news organizations, were definitely taking a harder look at race. And we here at Day to Day said, how can we do this intelligently and a bit differently from what other folks are doing? And I think one of the reasons why I like this particular piece is it speaks to the collaborative effort. I mean, you know, Madeline and I might be the voice of Day to Day that you hear, but there are so many other tremendous people who work behind the scenes. And this particular interview was a collaboration between myself and Deb Clark, who's currently our executive producer. And she just did an amazing job of putting this segment together. And Sylvester was suggested to us by Karen Grigsby Bates, who used to be a reporter on this program. And it was just our chance to try to have a very frank, edgy discussion about some things that are hard to talk about.
Well, this aired a bit almost 2 years ago, and I remember it quite vividly. Let's listen to this clip.
Mr. Monroe, if I might ask you to take your editor hat off for a moment and ask you personally, where do you stand on the use of the N-word? Is there a place for it at all?
I'm a great history buff. I don't like the idea of banning anything, because I think we are the sum total of who we are. African Americans without slavery would not be who we are today. The N-word has shaped us in ways good and bad. Now, I know that's counter to what my magazine, what the editor, my boss, has proposed. But you asked me to take my editor hat off, and I'm not speaking as a member, as a representative of Ebony magazine. But as an African-American, I think that there are responsible uses for that word.
Do you ever use the word yourself?
Never in public.
But in private?
In private, yes.
For what? When? When would be an instance?
I'm 55 years old. That word has been around, and I am very aware of its negative power and whatnot. And yet I see what the hip-hoppers, I see their point. I mean, it for me, that word rolls off my tongue when I'm in a private setting in my own home with an old dear friend and whatnot. The word comes as naturally as any other word. And yet, it's funny, it's like being bilingual. That word never comes to my mind when I'm in a public setting, in a professional setting, or in a mixed setting. It is simply part of the multicultural kind of society I live in. And I would dare say that there are words like that in many cultures and ethnicities that are used just like that. I reserve the right to use that word in private. But I also understand the negative connotations of that word and the hurt that it uses, and therefore I would never use it in public. you've gotten me to say something on the air, on national radio here, that I normally would not say. But I want to be really honest about this.
Sylvester Monroe, I appreciate your honesty, and I appreciate your taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Well, congratulations, Alex. Sylvester Monroe really sounded quite shocked that he had acknowledged what he did on the air.
And I'll add, that was a really amazing interview to be able to do. I'll add that that piece actually appeared in a segment that also included an amazing piece that came from Youth Radio, who they've just been incredible collaborators with us. And that was also the first time that they appeared on our show, the comic duo Frangela, who I just love. I mean, they're amazing. And they're day-to-day in my mind. Mm-hmm. You know, they're edgy. They're different. A lot of people love them. A lot of people hate them.
We get lots of letters when they're on the air.
Yeah. Yeah. They're definitely, everyone's got an opinion about them. And that's, I think, what our mission has been here, is to try to do something a little different that maybe not everybody likes, but at least it's different.
Well, speaking of things that are a little different, let's go to a piece by Madeline. On NPR.org, they list the most emailed stories by the different reporters and so on. And one of yours is the jellyfish story, invasion of jellyfish in Japan. And we're going to listen to a clip from later on in the story, but just quickly, the context. Why were you in Japan?
Okay, well, we went to Japan as part of the network's large Climate Connection series a couple of years ago. And it, they sent reporters all over the world to trace the effects of climate change and global warming. And we got to go to Japan. This was when we had a budget, a travel budget. So I went to Japan with my editor and producer, Martha Little, for 3 weeks. And we brought back several stories, several big, big stories about the changes there. And we also came across little stories and quirky stories like this one. This is about a guy who's a broker, a jellyfish broker. He has found his niche, his economic niche at least, in global warming. It's sort of a good news story about global warming, where because of increased pollution and warming oceans, it's changing the ecosystem in the waters, killing the big fish, but letting the jellyfish survive and thrive and actually become as big as, you know, washing machines in some cases. So this jellyfish broker took me to a restaurant to which he sells all this jellyfish, and is basically, we talk about how jellyfish might become the dominant cuisine in a few decades from now.
Well, let's pick it up from here. Here's Madeline Brand talking with Jellyfish Fukuda, or Fukuda-san, through an interpreter.
How big a problem is it for Japanese fishermen, these giant jellyfish?
Of course, this is a really big problem for the fishermen on the Sea of Japan, because these giant jellyfish get into the nets, and you can't get any more fish. You know, the fish die in the folds of these jellyfish. It's become so that these fishermen aren't able to fish, really. You know, they're just pulling up all these jellyfish all the time.
And yet, it's a good thing for you, because you have made it a business opportunity.
Sotori! That's right. It is a good chance for me, even though it's an environmental problem. I'm creating jellyfish makeup and skin products, which are very good for ladies with dry skin.
I'm looking at a picture of his, he has made an alcoholic drink, vodka, soda water, and jellyfish. What is your drink called? Does it have a name?
Jellyfish sour.
A jellyfish sour?
Yes, yes.
So what are those things floating? It's just bits of jellyfish?
Jellyfish.
There's jellyfish in
American jellyfish.
That's wonderful, Madeline.
Thank you.
What happens to you both and everyone else at day to day after tomorrow?
Well, it is a wide open future for us here. I mean, I don't think any of us have firm plans, right? I mean, maybe a couple of us, too, literally, have firm job offers. The rest of us are on the market.
Yes. I think a lot of rest happens. This has been, you know, it's been quite a journey, and especially the past couple of months. It's one thing to put on a radio show every day. It's another thing to put on a radio show every day when you know that that show's coming to an end and that you are joining the ranks of the unemployed in this economy. And it's definitely been a great final couple of months, but it's also been it's been hard. And I think a lot of us are looking forward to kind of decompressing a little bit from it all.
I will have a website up if I can plug that, if
please.
You want to check out what I will be doing. MadeleineBrand.com, M-A-D-E-L-E-I-N-E. And I'm on Facebook. And so if you're interested, I'll post my updates there. And you will too, right, Alex?
Yes. As it happens, Alex Cohen is not one of the world's more unique names. And an Israeli DJ has already beaten me to alexcohen.com. And a tech writer in the Bay Area has already beaten me to, I think, alexcohenwriter.com. But yes, I will. I actually am working on a blog as we speak. And I think one of our great colleagues has set up a Facebook page for those who want to keep up to date with what everyone on day-to-day, including our off-air staff, has been doing.
Yes.
So go to Facebook, and I'm there as well, and Twittering and all that good fun stuff. We're moving into a world that goes beyond radio.
Well, thank you both very much. I've enjoyed listening to Day Today since it went on the air. I'll look forward to listening to tomorrow's program, and best wishes to you all.
Thank you. And Jeffrey, I just want to say thank you, and thank you to the station for carrying the show and being such steadfast supporters of the show. It's been, I really, really appreciate it. We all do. And we've gotten lots of letters from listeners in your area, and we read them all, and we are just extremely gratified by the support that everyone has shown us. So thank you for that.
And if I could add to that as well, we've gotten a couple letters from folks saying that they're not going to support their local stations because of NPR. Don't do that, please. Even though we're going off the air, your local stations are really important, so keep that support coming.
Thank you both, Madeleine Brand, Alex Cohen, co-hosts of the NPR show Day Today, which ends tomorrow morning. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, jazz trumpeter Terrell Stafford will be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Jazz trumpeter Terrell Stafford is in town. He's at the Sacramento State Festival of the Arts tomorrow. Along with his career teaching jazz at Temple University, Stafford is a successful performer and has played with top names like McCoy Tyner and Christian McBride. But his career almost ended before it got started, as you'll hear. Terrell Stafford stopped by our studio this morning with his trumpet. He actually started out playing classical music and then moved to jazz. I asked him if it was his parents who'd wanted him to study classical.
No, it was exact opposite, actually. My parents were the ones that were saying, you should check out this Cannonball Adderley record, you know. This is some great stuff. You should listen to Nat Adderley. You should play jazz. And I was really influenced by my teachers and my peers, and they were saying, oh, we're going to work on this classical etude, and we're going to prepare for these auditions. And so my mindset was all around just classical music. And when I was doing auditions for colleges, that's all I was focused on. I didn't even pursue a college that had a jazz program. And it wasn't until after I graduated from my undergraduate degree, quit trumpet for 6 months, came back to trumpet, and that's when I was near the end of my graduate degree when I started to play jazz.
So that was relatively late that you turned to jazz trumpet.
Mm-hmm. It was late, yeah. But I was discouraged by a lot of people around me, especially the people in the classical program. You know, like, why would you do that? Why would you do that? You've invested so much. And then the jazz people were saying, well, you don't really know about the vocabulary. You don't have a feel. You don't have this. But it was something that I heard at the time. And I don't know, maybe I was influenced by that first recording my father played me years ago. And it, you know, kind of stuck with me. And that's why I came back to it.
You said that you quit trumpet for 6 months after you graduated, after you got your undergraduate degree. Why did you quit trumpet?
Well, when I was in school, my teacher wasn't really crazy about my embouchure. So I don't play right in the center. You know, I play a little bit off to the side. And you know, I had a great teacher as an undergraduate in my undergraduate program. But he was very much that, you know, we had to play the same mouthpiece he did, and the same trumpet he did, and same everything. And that didn't, I couldn't play the exact same equipment he did, and it just didn't work that well for me. So,
how do you mean? What was the problem?
Well, everyone's teeth and everyone's lips are different, and everyone has a different comfort level. So someone may feel comfortable playing a smaller diameter mouthpiece, and others may feel comfortable playing a larger diameter. And I felt more comfortable playing a larger diameter. So, and by the fact that I didn't play in the center, you know, he was like, well, you know, if you keep that up, I'm not sure if you have much of a future, you know, because you got to get it right in the center. All the great trumpet players play right in the center. So as soon as I finished my degree, I was like, well, if the great trumpet players play in the center and I don't, that's my message. That's enough for me. And so I got a minor in math and a minor in computers. So I tutored in trigonometry, and I worked as a computer programmer for an insurance company.
Wow.
Yeah.
And where do you play trumpet now?
Same spot. Nope. No. Same spot. After I quit, I went to hear Wynton Marsalis play, and he was playing with the Eastman Wind Ensemble. And after his concert, I went and spoke to him, and he shook my hand. He said, "So, man, what do you do?" I said, "Well, I work for this insurance company." He goes, "You play trumpet? You play any music?" I said, "Yeah, I played trumpet. I played in my undergraduate days, but I'm not playing much now." He's like, "Why not?" I said, "Well, you know, I don't play right here in the center," and I was blah, blah, blah. He goes, "Man, it doesn't matter where you put the mouthpiece." He goes, "I'm going to send you to my teacher and let him hear you. And if he thinks that you should continue, he'll let you know." And I did that. And the teacher was Professor William Fielder. And I went and took a lesson with him. And it changed my life.
Now, Wynton Marsalis is well known for many things, among them being that he has managed to keep together this dual career as a classical trumpet player and a jazz trumpet player.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever gone back to playing classical trumpet?
A few years ago, there was a piece for symphony and trumpet that was written for me, and I did that. But and supposedly this fall, I'm supposed to do something with the orchestra, not the Philly Orchestra, but the Temple Orchestra at Carnegie Hall, but I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. It's just that now it's really hard. I mean, everything that I practice, my routine, so to speak, is basically classical. But it's a different confidence, you know, standing up playing a concerto as opposed to playing a tune. So it's hard to really, you know, straddle that line. And that's Wynton's thing too, you know. He doesn't play much classical music anymore. It's just hard, and it's really nerve-wracking to go back and have to do it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Terrell Stafford is a jazz trumpeter. He plays this evening at 8 at the Sacramento State Music Recital Hall as part of the campus's Festival of the Arts. When you quit trumpet for 6 months, did you think, "Well, I'm going to come back to it at some point," or did you think, "Well, that's it, trumpet, that was great, but it's over"?
You know, I didn't even have a thought. I just wanted to get away from the trumpet for the reasons that I felt, you know, like I invested, this was something I really wanted to do, and I invested my life doing this, well, my four-year life, or I started at 13, so up to 18, from 13 to 18, it seemed like a long time for me, and I invested all that time and all this time into practice, and then to find out that, you know, there may not be a future because of an amateur, and I just, and when I was in school, I used a lot of pressure as well, and sometimes my lips would be cut up to the point that I'd have to put preparation H to play the gig the next day, you know, to get the swelling down. It was just because I used an incredible amount of pressure. And so it was great, really good that I stopped for those months. And then when I came back, I'd forgotten a lot of the bad habits I was doing. And, you know, my new teacher, Fielder, Professor Fielder, was really, really insightful and pointing me in the right direction and getting me to use more air and changing the whole concept of playing the trumpet for me.
When other professional trumpet players hear you, can they tell that you started out playing something other than jazz trumpet? Is there something about your technique, the way you play, the way you sound, that might cause someone else who knows what they're listening to tell that you came from something else?
I guess. You know, I think that what I practice helps. Well, I love sound, first of all, first and foremost. I love sound, and my favorite sound is Bud Herseth, and because his sound is just so clear and full through all the registers, and that was a huge influence on me when I was younger. And so even now, I still listen to a lot of the Chicago Symphony and listen to his playing, and it's really inspirational. So some people can hear the fact that my sound is classical, and my equipment is pretty big. It's not, quote unquote, a jazz setup in some ways. You know, I play almost a 1.5 C mouthpiece, which is it's getting more and more common now. The jazz players are starting to play larger equipment. But I guess when people hear me, they can hear it from the sound. I think my technique's okay. I don't think I have, like, outrageous technique. You know, I can name some people that may, but I'm not sure if they can hear the classical influence, but for me, I can feel it because, you know, being on the road all the time, you know, I see different players go through different chop things. And I have a routine design, and my routine's designed as a troubleshooting routine, kind of like programs that you would run, being a, you know, computer programmer. You'd run a program to find out what the kinks are in the system and then go back and fix those kinks. Well, I try to design my trumpet routine in that same way. So I can usually fix some of the problems that are going on with certain aspects of my plan, which helps when I teach my students, because when they go through something, I say, oh, yeah, I remember I went through that same thing.
Like, what kind of kink would there be in trumpet playing that you could hear and fix through practice?
Everything. You could fix sound. You can fix articulation, endurance, range. Every aspect about trumpet playing is a kink. I mean, but if you sat around a table and everyone spoke about what they had gone through, just chop-wise, in the past month, you could just have a whole list of things that people were working on, whether it's sound, or I really can't get this note to speak like I wanted to, or, you know, my flexibility isn't what I want it to be, and my tonguing is terrible, I can't get a pop on the attack, or, you know, my double tonguing is really lagging now. I mean, it's amazing to sit around and talk to trumpet players and find out the different things people are going through.
You have your trumpet with you, mm-hmm. and you're going to play something for us. What are you going to play?
I figured since we're talking about embouchure and things like this, I'll play a song called The Touch of Your Lips.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow, Terrell Stafford, jazz trumpeter in our studio. He played just now The Touch of Your Lips. This evening at 8, he's playing at the Sacramento State Music Recital Hall as part of the campus's Festival of the Arts. You know, just in those 3 minutes, Terrell, you had to produce and control a lot of air to do that. What do you have to do to prepare for a concert?
Oh, well, as I said about the routine earlier, I like to do a lot of breathing exercises. That's the first thing I do in the morning before I play. You know, some people are like, well, I got to warm up my lips. I really don't necessarily think about warming up my lips is more than I think about breathing. So this, I use two syllables when I play, and the syllables I use are ho and hu. So I use like a ho syllable for my inhale and a hu syllable for my exhale. And the hu syllable forms my embouchure, and it keeps everything forward in my face. So if things stay forward, then I can alleviate pressure and alleviate tension. And so that's what I do to prepare for a concert. When I warm up, I just breathe, you know, breathe. And I play exercises that get my air flowing, because between air and the pivot of the trumpet, I can direct my air in different ways that help me to play in different registers without having to kill my lip.
Is it physically tiring to do that?
It is. I think, you know, playing a brass instrument is very tiring, because it's so much breathing. You know, I think to prepare for a concert as well, I left this out, is that I think, you know, to stay in shape, you know, so I usually run 3 miles a day. I didn't yesterday because I was in Denver, and I'm always a little afraid of that altitude there, especially getting there for the first day. But usually I do that, and that helps. And just the whole pacing and, you know, running and breathing is the same kind of breathing I would do when I play the trumpet. You know, good inhales, deep inhales, and timing out my breaths according to what the music dictates. And I do the same thing on a run, you know, timing out my breaths according to my pace.
You've played with a lot of famous jazz musicians, but I noticed in your bio that you've also worked with the 2006 All Alaska Jazz Band. Now, excuse my ignorance if that's famous in jazz circles, but the All Alaska Jazz Band, it just sounded like a... Like almost paradoxical.
Well, you know, I work with them, but I was conductor.
Ah,
yeah, I was the conductor of the All Alaska Band. It was,
are they all Alaskans?
They were all Alaskans. Yes, I think there was maybe, you know, a couple people from California, but everyone else was from Alaska.
Is jazz big in Alaska?
The band was pretty good. It's, you know, it's the problem that I don't know why it's that problem, but the students being exposed to the music was a real problem. There were a lot of recordings, fundamental recordings, that a lot of them hadn't heard. And so it was a really fun week because, you know, sometimes in teaching situations, when you're put in a position to teach people that know everything, it's really hard to share anything with them. But when you, or they think they know everything, but when you're put in a position where people are like, well, we have no idea what you're talking about, then it's easy to kind of, you know, introduce them to different concepts and different records and different ways to approach music. So working with that band was really interesting, and they have a great festival in Sitka, Alaska, and Juneau as well. I played a festival there, and the people are so into it. It's amazing, really amazing.
You're director of jazz studies at Temple University, so I'm guessing you have some pretty high-performing students there, though.
Some really good students there and really nice students, you know. I enjoy teaching there a lot. That's why I've stayed all these years. I've taught at different places, you know, while I was teaching at Temple. I was teaching at Juilliard for a while, too, but that got to be a little much juggling the two. And then when Juilliard became accredited, I had to leave because of my 10-year contract. But I had no desire to teach at any place but Temple. I mean, the administration's great. The students are great. It's a great situation. They allow me to travel, and my students are supportive of my travel, you know. Sent me a couple of texts this morning, you know, how's California, you know, wish we were there, but, you know, so it's nice. And I love to, you know, to be out on the road with a band like the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra, and to be, you know, around such incredible musicians and hear stories and hear people practice and hear people play night to night. And when they're playing and they're sharing and we're all talking, I kind of bring that back to my students and say, hey, this is what such and such did to prepare for this. Or if a student's having a particular problem, I'll ask someone in the band, hey, what do you think about this? One of my students is struggling with this, and someone will give some insight, and I'll come back and share it with my students and say, next time you're in New York, get a lesson with, you know, Billy Drews or with Rich Perry or, you know, John Mosca, because they're the ones who answered the questions that you had that I couldn't answer. So
don't worry about which part of the mouth you play the trumpet in.
Yeah, don't worry about, you know. And, you know, it's funny because some of the trumpet players at the school, one in particular came to the school as a freshman, and I heard a lot of potential in him, but he was really confused because of the same situation that I was confused about when I was younger, just not really sure where to put things. And it just, it gets to the point, you know, I play the trumpet just like a whistle. So exactly where my embouchure is when I play is exactly. So once he found what was comfortable for him and he wasn't, you know, being forced to do something else, you know, within like a year or two, his range went from an F at the top of the staff to probably a G or A above that. So, you know,
an octave,
yeah.
Wow.
It just from, you know, not having to do what a textbook may say, because everyone's different. You know, his teeth are different than mine. So I can't say, you know, it's like me saying, okay, every student has to play off to the center like me. And if you don't, you can't study with me, because, you know, it's crazy. So we, you know, just giving people the opportunity to explore where things are comfortable. And then our job as a teacher is to make sure that we guide them in the direction that they should be going in to prepare themselves.
Terrell Stafford, jazz trumpeter. He plays this evening at 8 at the Sacramento State Music Recital Hall, part of the campus's Festival of the Arts. Terrell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's been great.
We talked earlier today. You couldn't see it because this is radio, but Terrell Stafford really did whistle out of the side of his mouth. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, poet Catherine Coles. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A young poet in Utah saw her career really take off last fall with the publication of her first collection of poems. Catherine Coles, who's still a graduate teaching assistant, won a National Poetry Prize because of the book. Tomorrow she comes to Sacramento to speak at Sacramento State's Festival of the Arts. I spoke with her earlier today and asked what the unusual title of her book, Eleanor Eleanor, Not Her Real Name, means.
Well, there's a character in the book of poems called Eleanor, and who jumps in and out of various poems and is this kind of resistant character and playful character. And the character is and is not based on somebody I knew, and so Eleanor is and is not. It's an invented name, but it is and is not a person I knew, and so that's where I got the name.
Well, that's very tantalizing, is and is not based on someone you know. Can you go into that in some more detail?
Well, the book started out, I started writing it because I had this friend who I had lost, who I couldn't find, who she had been somewhat homeless and wandering around, and I had no idea where she was and no way to track her down. And I didn't know what to do about these feelings of loss, and so I started writing poems about them. And so this character, Eleanor, I didn't want to use her real name, and this character, Eleanor, kind of started out of her, but then the character took hold of the book and became someone quite different from her, and in part, I think, autobiographical in certain ways. And so, you know, it was no longer her by the end of the book, although it is very much her at the beginning of the book.
And why did you call this character Eleanor?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think I just like the name.
Now, you said that this character, this Eleanor character, is and is not based on this real person.
Mm-hmm.
But you sort of tip your hand in the title by saying Eleanor, Eleanor, not your real name.
That's very true. I'm interested in playing with that line of real and not real. I have, for instance, in all of the sections of the books, I have a picture, a photograph, or a collage as a kind of instance of evidence of actual tangible things, and yet I'm always playing with, you know, is this a real person or is this me? Is this real evidence or is this falsified evidence? I have translated poems in the book that are entirely false translations of originals, you know, that name me in them. Of course, I wasn't in the original Lorca poem, but suddenly there's a Catherine in the newer poem, so.
Yeah. You know, very often when a book has a central character, it's a novel. But this is a collection of poems. Did it occur to you, since you had this character that you really wanted to explore, that perhaps you could do it justice also by writing a novel?
It did occur to me. I hadn't realized, though, how narrative the poem or the book was until I started putting the poems together, because the poems themselves are quite lyric and kind of settle on particular instances, and yet you know, the book is about quite a bit more than Eleanor. It's about not just loss in the case of this friend, but it turns into being about loss in my life. And I had an uncle who died of alcoholism, and I was going through this divorce and was having all of this stuff happen. And I realized once I put these poems together that there was a narrative arc to the book that I hadn't kind of realized was there. So I think the narrative details and the kind of characterization that would be novel-like came when I put the book together. I wasn't so much thinking about that when I made it, but afterward I thought, you know, wow, I've kind of written a novel in poems without meaning to.
My guest is Catherine Cole. She's a poet and writing teacher. She speaks tomorrow afternoon at 2 at the Sacramento State University Library as part of the campus's Festival of the Arts. She's the author of Eleanor, Eleanor, Not Your Real Name, winner of the Dorothy Brunsman Poetry Prize, and she's a graduate teaching assistant at the University of Utah's Department of English. You've written that this book of poems, that you wanted to investigate the concept of character as it intersects with form. Now, what does that mean?
Well, I tried a lot of different kinds of poems in this book, some of them traditional, like villanelles or rhyming poems, but then I have poems in the form of lists and poems in the form of interviews. I have, like I said, the false translations. I have a dictionary poem that essentially steals definitions directly from the dictionary, but the way the Eleanor figure comes in is through the examples, the italicized examples, the usage of the word or the etymologies of the word. And so I think what I was trying to do is set up instances where this Eleanor figure could escape, or from which this Eleanor figure could escape, forms from which she could escape, and set the stage for the kind of playfulness of the figure. But it was a lot of fun to try out different forms and kind of throw the character against the forms to see what would happen.
Now, you have a poem to read for us from Eleanor, Eleanor, Not Your Real Name. Which poem is it?
There's a list poem that talks about Eleanor at the beginning of the poem. Does that sound like a good one?
Please.
It's called About Eleanor, and it's numbered. 1. Was small and is still for all I know. 2. The wart under her lip looked like a beauty mark. 3. Was a beauty and is still for all I know. 4. A beauty with a limp. 5. Was always dusted with dirt. During a stint at a bakery, it was flour. 6. Could climb trees well. Her smallness was an asset. 7. One leg nearly always broken. 8. Broken or with a limp. 9. Brown hair. 10. At least one of her bones came from a donor. 11. Legs unshaven like trees in the wild. 12. Could ride her bicycle downhill when her leg was broken, but not back up. 13. Not a swimmer, but able to swim. Superior floater. 14. On Sundays, we would float down a moss, weedy stream, and when churchgoers walked by, we'd duck under the water and breathe through reeds. 15. They could still see us. Of course, that was not the point. 16. Was a knitter, scarves, and hats. 17. One summer, we planted a purple petunia behind some bushes in memory of our favorite swing set, removed for safety. We watered the petunia at night in secret until someone found it and pulled it up as a weed. 18. Green eyes, green with extra E's and N's, slivers of triangle iris, her strongest muscle of all. 19. Needless to say. 20. Was allergic to cashews, craved cashews. 21. Was a painter and is still for all I know. 22. Purchased thrift store paintings just to paint over the canvases. 23. Sometimes all white or all red or all green. 24. Was not really called Eleanor. 25. That part's mine.
Wow. That's one of the most vivid poems I can remember hearing in a long time.
Thank you.
Why did you number all those qualities of Eleanor?
Well, I wanted it to appear like a list, and a list that kind of shook out of the list form in the different narrative sections. So I was literally trying to make a list, so I numbered the qualities.
And when you wrote this, did you just sit down and brainstorm and go right the way through it? Or was this something that, you know, you're walking to the supermarket and you got an idea and you scribbled it down and 2 days later you thought of another two?
That's a very good question. I think what happened was, with most of the poems, I just would sit down and write them very quickly. And I think I spent a lot of time thinking about the Eleanor figure and thinking about, you know, situations and things like that. But when it came to actually writing the poems, after all the thinking was done, I would sit down and do it within a matter of 10 minutes and then be done with it.
What was your goal in writing that particular poem? Because some of these, they seem like random thoughts, but mm-hmm. clearly they weren't.
Well, that poem comes very early on in the manuscript, and I think I was trying to to establish this character as a real physical character in many ways before I started playing with her as a kind of a conceptual character. And I wanted to locate her in time and space, essentially. I wanted to give her qualities, and I wanted her to feel real early on. That was important to me.
Some of the items in that list poem were entirely about Eleanor, but some of them seemed more about the author.
Absolutely.
And why was that?
Because I think that ultimately the character was there and is there for a kind of a self-exploration, because this person I started writing the book about, I didn't have around me anymore, and the figure was a way to explore what was going on with me as much as to remember her. And so I think there's a kind of a collapse of the Eleanor figure and me and the author. In the poetry world, we like to say the speaker, but with this book, it is quite literally me, the author, collapsed with this figure. And often when I'm talking about her, I'm really talking about myself.
My guest is the poet Catherine Cole. She speaks tomorrow afternoon at 2 at Sacramento State as part of the Festival of the Arts. There's another poem in Eleanor, Not Your Real Name. I haven't read it, but I'd like to talk about it with you. It's about another loss. It's a recurring theme in the book. Loss of a friend called Andy Smith, who's been lost because his name is so common, she can't track him down. And that really jarred me when I read that, because Google doesn't have much time for people with names like Andy Smith.
No, it's very hard. And for a while, I know that he was living in Portland, Oregon, because when I lived in Portland, he was there, and I could track him down at that point. But when I went back years later to try and find him, I couldn't, because his name is so common. I tried cold calling a few people out of the phone book, but had an impossible time with it. I think it's another way to lose track of somebody. The book is concerned with naming, of course. The title tells that, but I think that's it's a name that's equally hollowed out as Eleanor in certain respects, because it becomes nonspecific just because it's so common.
Things have really taken off for you quite quickly, Catherine, if I may say. I mean, your first collection, Eleanor, Not Your Real Name, was just published last September. And you're still actually a graduate teaching assistant at the University of Utah. And here you are, you're crossing part of the country to speak at a festival of the arts. You won a prize, a prestigious prize, the Dorothy Brunsman Poetry Prize. Did you have an idea that this book, when you were working on it, was going to have the impact that it's had?
I think one always hopes when one is writing that something will come of it, but I hadn't thought of it. It hadn't possibly occurred to me that it, you know, would win a prize and would be published so quickly. So that was a real pleasure to discover.
You're also interested in music, as I understand, and I read that you started playing guitar because everyone else in your family played piano. Is that true, or is that a joke?
No, it's absolutely true. My father is a blues and jazz pianist, and my mother's a classical pianist. And I was the second child in the family, quite a large family of five children. And I, all of my siblings were excellent and are excellent pianists, and so I felt like I needed to do something different.
Is that like you, to follow your own path, and that this path diverges from where everyone else is?
I think so. I think that's a characteristic that I have.
What do your family, your piano-playing family, make of your poetry career?
Well, my piano-playing family is also a family full of English majors. So they're my parents are both involved in the literature side. They're professors of literature, but my siblings, many of them got degrees and advanced degrees in English and in literature. So they understand it. I think that they were surprised to see me. I was originally headed down the literature path. I wanted to be a professor of Victorian literature, but I quickly changed my tune once I got to graduate school and found myself writing poems all the time.
Eleanor's kind of a Victorian literature name, isn't it?
That's an excellent point. I think probably that's where its origin is somehow.
As a poet and a musician, do you write lyrics to songs?
I do. I write lyrics to songs, and I'm very interested in the difference between lyrics and poems, how one does not necessarily translate into the other.
Well, what is the difference?
Well, I think that lyrics are more sound-based. You can get away with words that don't actually rhyme with each other, rhyming with each other, just by the way that you pronounce them. There's an echo when you're writing lyrics that you can use to your benefit, and it's a sound-based echo, whereas poems, I think, are necessarily more visual. Of course, there are sound elements to just about every poem, but the echo is often a visual echo and not sound related at all, because you don't necessarily hear them or say them out loud when you're reading them on the page. So there are different ways to there are different tactics when I'm writing a song that can kind of move people or emphasize certain parts of the song that you can't do so much with poetry. You do different things with poetry.
Could you imagine the poem you read for us earlier being set to music in any way?
That's an interesting question. I couldn't, and part of the reason is I'm not sure how to. It feels to me so not necessarily musical. Some of the poems I think are more musical in the book, but that one in particular I think is not necessarily meant to be musical. And I've tried before to set some of my poems to music, and it doesn't tend to go terribly well for me. I've also tried to take lyrics from songs before and use them as poems, and that also doesn't go well. There's something lost in the translation, I think.
Catherine Coles, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure talking with you.
It was nice to talk to you, too.
Catherine Coles, tomorrow at 2 at the Sacramento State Festival of Fine Arts. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. And by the way, this is the last time Insight airs at 2 p.m. We return on Monday at our new time of 10 a.m. Tomorrow, there's a California Lecture special with the inimitable Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket. Today's associate producers were Nathan Wilkinson and Rebecca Markison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Our executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us.